Okay. All right. So let's get started here. So what I'm going to do today is to finish up the last few slides on security and then start a new topic, namely distributed file system. Okay. The new topic is going to be maybe 2-3 lectures long. Today we'll do an introduction and also look at NFS. And then next time you're going to look at other issues in distributed file system. So before I finish up on security, are there any questions on what we've discussed so far? So we looked last time at authentication. We looked at message digests and digital signatures, as well as how to do secure email and what firewalls do for us and so on. Okay, so we'll continue from that point on. So I'm going to talk about a protocol called Kerberos, and then we will use that to understand how to design secure distributed services. Okay, and then there'll be one more slide, and then we're going to wrap up. Okay, now, if you remember when I started this topic, I talked about Telnet, which is a remote login application that does not have any security built in. Okay, so meaning that when you set up a Telnet connection, you get a user prompt. You send your username. Okay, and it prompts you for the password. You specify the password. Both of these go in clear text, and subsequent communication also goes in clear text. Okay, so any intruder can intercept these messages and figure out what is going on. And there are many services like this. FTP by default also is an encrypted. Distributed file systems like NFS or Samba are also not encrypted. And if you just do email using IMAP, that also is not encrypted. It uses authentication and it downloads your mail. So everything is going in clear text. Okay. Now, for each of these, there are replacements which say or which make the communication more secure. So for Telnet, replacement is SSH. Okay, SSH sets up the secure channel, allows you to encrypt every packet before sending it in. Okay, HTTP unencrypted, there's a SSL version that we talked about last time, which allows you to set up secure connections. Okay, so one approach is to take every service for which you need security and develop a replacement for that service, which is a secure version. Okay, so that means redesigning the service to add security in there. Okay, there is another way to achieve this, where you layer security underneath the service. So service itself does not have to change. Okay, in other words, by default, if you use this other technique, which is going to be Kerberos, then every connection is going to be encrypted and the service can run on top of that. Since the underlying connection is already encrypted, anything that you send doesn't have to be re-encrypted. You can send things in clear text, but the pipe itself is encrypted. Okay, is this clear? What's the difference between the two? Yes, no. Clear, right? So we'll now talk about how to do this in the context of Kerberos. So assume that you want to do a remote login. Okay, your question.
Can SSL be classified as the second thing that you said?
Yes, so of course. So that's a good point. So why SSL is an example of something like this. So there are many ways to achieve this. I'm going to talk about Kerberos as one of the many examples, because it is not just setting up the secure connection, it is also authentication. Okay, SSL also only sets up a secure connection, okay, but authentication is another issue where if you have to send a password over the network, it's vulnerable to getting intercepted. Okay, so if you can do authentication such that your password never even goes over the network, yet you authenticate yourself to the system, that's even better. Okay, so you want not only to authenticate yourself, but also use secure channels wherever possible. Okay, so SSL would allow you to do address one of the two problems, meaning the setting of the secure channel connects, but it doesn't address the second issue, which is authentication. Okay, so that's something to keep in mind. Now we'll see what Kerberos does for us. So here is Alice. Okay, that's Alice's machine. Now she wants to log in to another machine. Okay, so remote login. But you're not going to use SSH to do this. So how does Kerberos work? Yes, so you basically specify your login name saying I am Alice. And then what happens is there are two entities in Kerberos. There's an authentication server called AS and there's a ticket granting service called TGS. Okay, the ticket granting service sets up session keys, so which is referred to as a ticket in Kerberos. So ticket is basically a session key that allows you to access any network service, allows you to set up secure channel. Okay? So first you have to authenticate, and then you get a ticket for whatever service you want to access. So if you want to do remote login, you get a remote login ticket, and that allows you to log in into any system. Okay? So there are two entities. So what you first do is you tell the authentication server saying, I'm Alice. Yeah, I need to authenticate. So what that authentication server does is it looks up Alice in the database, and it generates a session key, but a key that allows Alice to get to the ticket granting service. Okay? So here is a key that is going to allow Alice to talk to the ticket granting service. Okay? Then there is you also construct a ticket. It's a sort of authentication to the server. So it's saying, I am Alice. And here is the key that you are supposed to use. That's the same key as there. Okay, and these two entities are encrypted by a key that is only known to the AS and TGS. So there is a key that only these two entities know. So you basically say Alice wants to talk to you. Here is the keys that you are supposed to use to talk to Alice, and you encrypt it with a key that's only known to these two entities. Okay, you send this back. Okay, and this whole thing is encrypted with a secret key that is only known to Alice and the authentication service. Okay? So this message comes back. So what Alice's workstation does is say, give me your password, because at this point you only specified the login name and all these things happened. Okay? Now Alice's workstation is going to prompt Alice for a password. And what this password does is it unlocks this secret key that is already on the workstation. Is this clear? So there is this key that is used to encrypt this message. So in order for Alice's workstation to decrypt it, you need to access the key. Okay? So the password is actually protecting the key, not a password to log into the system. Okay? So you prompt for the password. Password is specified that unlocks the key. So the workstation extracts KAAS, which is the key that is known to Alice's workstation and AS. Okay, you get this key, which is stored locally in a file in an encrypted form. Okay, and then you can get this message out. Okay? So now you got a session key to talk to the ticket granting service, and you have an encrypted version of the session key that you can send. Okay, that is exactly what you do. You take the session key. Yeah, this is basically this part of the message, and then you stick it here, and then you send a message saying, I'm Bob, I want to talk to Bob, meaning I want to log on to a different workstation, give me a ticket, and then you send the time, current time, to the ticket granting service encrypted, the session.
What's the meaning of TGS
thing? TGS, ticket granting service. Ticket granting service, it gives out tickets. Okay. So you send this message over, then the ticket granting service is going to construct a session key for Alice and Bob. Okay? Send this back encrypted, as well as send the key to be sent to Bob. So this is a variant of the Needham-Schroeder protocol that we talked about last time, okay, which involved nonces and so on. So instead of a nonce here, you're sending a time to prevent replay attacks. Okay? Your time is being, current time, system time is being used as a nonce. AS and TGS are logical entities. They could run on the same machine. They could run on different machines. Okay, they are just two components of Kerberos. So the basic idea is to first authenticate yourself to the system. Once you've authenticated to the system and gotten a way to talk to the ticket granting service, anytime you want to access any service, you say, I want to access this service, construct a session key. And a session key comes back. And you use that session key to then establish a connection, a secure connection to that machine. And then all data is now goes over the secure connection. Okay, so that's the two things I mentioned. You need to authenticate and you need to set up secure channels. Okay? So any service that is currently used, which may not be encrypted, can be Kerberized by making it use the system and have you set up a secure connection. And then you run on top of that connection. That's the basic idea. Is this clear? What we have talked about? Yes, your question. Just one second. Yes, go ahead.
What happens in the key between the B and TGS? And what does it do?
Okay, so I haven't shown the next steps, right? So here you've only gotten this key so far. This allows you to, this is a session key that allows you to talk to Bob. So the next step is Alice's workstation sets up a secure connection to Bob, okay, by exchanging this key, saying I'm Alice, I want to set up a secure connection, here is the session key. Okay, and that allows you to set up a secure connection.
And how does it unlock, like for example, it was possible to unlock the KAAS?
Yes.
How does it unlock the KATGS?
KATGS. This thing?
Yeah.
This is not never unlocked. This is just sent over to the TGS, right? This is just taken from this message and stuck here and sent over.
No, I meant how is the shared between Alice and the TGS?
Between Alice and the TGS, there is no shared key. That is the key that was sent to you here.
Oh.
Not predefined. It's basically that's what you do. You say, tell the authentication server, I am Alice. I need to talk to the ticket granting service. Here is, and then you authenticate yourself. It says, okay, here is a key that you can use to talk to the ticket granting service. That is this key. Then subsequently, you tell the ticket granting service that use this session key to then say, I want to talk to Bob. Construct a session key to talk to Bob. So that comes back to you here. That's this key. Oh, sorry, this one. This key here. And then you set up a connection to Bob. Is this clear? So you authenticate and get a key to talk to the ticket granting service, and you talk to the ticket granting service, get a session key for any service you want to access. Yes, question there. There already has to be a key between Bob and the ticket granting service. There also has to be a key between Alice and the authentication server. Yes, absolutely. Okay. And this key is not unlike your SSH keys, right? If you know how SSH works, SSH also does not send your password over a network. Okay, what SSH has done is it has taken your private key and it has encrypted it with your password. Okay, so when you set up an SSH connection, all the login prompt merely unlocks your private key, and that private key is used to set up a connection. And your public key is known. Okay, so same thing is true in SSH, but SSH is a simpler variant of what is happening here. It's only designed for remote logins. Okay, yes,
so
question.
The functionality of TGS is just to assign a key between A and B.
Yes.
And what's the functionality of Alice workstation? What's the difference between Alice and Alice workstation?
Okay, what's the difference between, this is a person, this is a machine, that's all. Otherwise, there is no conceptual difference.
You mean, such as Alice can use a network to.
Exactly. Right. So the idea behind Kerberos is, that you authenticate yourself to the entire system, and you, once you have done that, you get access to the ticket granting service. From this point on, if you want to access any service, you just say, now here, construct a session key, and then you can set up a secure channel. So it could be Bob, and then you could set up a connection with machine C. Okay, and then you basically do the same thing. You go back to the ticket granting service. You're already authenticated, so you don't need to do this more than once. This is done once, so this is also referred to as single sign-on. Okay, so once you are signed on to Kerberos, you never have to specify your password so long as your ticket doesn't expire. Okay, so you sign in once in for the system, and every service can be accessed by just going to the ticket granting service and then setting up a secure channel. So you don't have to retype your password to access mail once you have logged in, for example. Okay, that's the way this works. Yes, your question. What is the requirement of KASTGS? This is just a way for the authentication service to tell the ticket granting service that Alice has authenticated herself successfully.
But if Alice has gotten ATGS, doesn't that suffice?
If Alice has gotten ATGS, that still doesn't tell the ticket granting service that you actually talked to the authentication server. This could have been generated by some other entity, right? Because there are two things here. You have to authenticate yourself. This is an encrypted message that telling the ticket granting service that you have authenticated yourself. So every time you want to set up a session, you have to send this back to the ticket granting service. This just shows that you have authenticated. And then this guy certified that you have authenticated. Okay, that's all that's being done here. Yes. These two? No, these are just generated one time and they are just shared between these two and no one else knows this.
So why do we need to keep on asking the KATGS?
Why do we need to keep on? So this is done once, only once. This is done as many times as you need to access service. So let me give you an example, right? So suppose you want to first log into a remote machine and then you want to, let's say, access mail, and suppose that mail also requires password for whatever reason. Okay, if you did this, normally you would specify your password twice, that you would first log in, and then you would, to open up mail, you would provide your password again. In Kerberos, you only sign in once to the entire system, okay, entire distributed system. You specify your password once, so you do this step only once. And once you have gotten this, you can go to the ticket granting service and get as many tickets as you want. Okay, that allows you to basically sign into as many services as you want subsequently. That's the whole idea. Any questions here?
The clocks need to synchronize.
The clocks need synchronize because there's a nonce that is being used. Time is being used as a nonce instead of an integer in this case. Yeah. Okay? Yes, you have more questions here.
This one? No,
the last one. This one. This is the nonce that you are sending in an encrypted form. Yes. T is the time. So instead of
time.
You are using the current time as a nonce, that's all.
Okay,
this could have been a nonce. Think of this as a nonce. You're just using time as a nonce. But it could be once in a lifetime number, which is also time, right? Because if you use integers in the current time as the integer, that's also a nonce in some sense. Okay? Any other questions? So maybe next time I can actually show how this works, because we have Kerberos running in the department. So I don't think very many people use it, but I couldn't get it to work. If I can get it to work next time, meaning I have to do some setup to get it to work, I'll show you how it works. Okay? Any other questions here before I move on? Okay. So electronic payment systems is the last thing I want to talk about, and then we'll talk about file systems. So again, here what we want to do is use the concepts that we have for encryption and authentication to understand how to do electronic payments. Okay, so I'm going to just walk you through what is done right now, what are the three forms of payments we use all the time, and then we'll talk about different form of electronic payment. Okay. So if you want to buy something today, your choices are you pay for that service or goods in cash, you write a check, or you write a use a credit card. Okay? So this is what happens when you use cash. Okay? Suppose that all of your money is in the bank. Okay? So you have to first go and withdraw some cash, okay, and then you make a payment to whoever you are buying this from. And that person will then subsequently take your cash and deposit it into their bank. Okay? That's the assumption. Or maybe use that to buy some other good. Doesn't matter. That's how cash works. So this is what happens when you write a check. Okay? So you basically, your bank issues you a checkbook. Okay? In order to make a payment, you write a check, give it to the payee. Okay? Payee is then going to cash the check, which means they deposit it into their bank. Okay? And their bank has to go through a settlement process in order to receive the payment. Okay? So their bank, the settlement process usually involves either sending a check or some image of the check to your bank. Your bank verifies that you actually signed the check, that it's not forged, and then sends back the payment, okay, whatever is specified in the check. That's called a settlement. Okay? So, and then that money comes to the payee's bank. Okay, credit card transactions are somewhat similar. Okay, bank issues or some credit card company issues a credit card to you. Okay, in order to make a payment, you basically provide the credit card number to the merchant. Okay, and then you may sign a slip to say that you have agreed to pay for those goods or services. Then the merchant actually goes to their bank, okay, or their credit card company, saying, here is a payment instruction I have received, and then why don't you go and do the settlement? Yeah, the same settlement cycle goes through. The credit card company, or in this case, let's assume it's the same as the bank, then goes to your bank or the company that issues your credit card and says, here is a request for payment. then your that company actually sent the payment over. And at some later point, you have to pay your bank, which I have not shown here. Okay. So these are forms of, so these two are forms of electronic payments. Okay. Now, the major difference between A and B and C is that in case of A, the payee can remain anonymous to the merchant. Okay, if you just go and buy something and you just pay for it in cash, the merchant has no record of who bought these goods, okay? Because you don't have to provide any identification or anything like that. Okay? In the other two cases, when you specify, give a check or a credit card number, you are actually leaving a trail. Okay, that you can, things can be tracked back to you. Okay, because either there is an account number or some your bank information, or the credit card information and your name. Okay, so these two are not anonymous, but using cash is anonymous. Okay, so one question is, can you actually construct an electronic payment system where the identity of the payee is protected, meaning it looks similar to cash, okay, but you are using an electronic form of transactions. Okay, so I'm going to show one way to do this, and then I'll talk about, this is not actually used in practice, but there are other ways to do the same thing, which I will talk about in just a moment. Okay. So this is called e-cash. Okay, so the electronic form of cash. Okay, again, the property we want is to do all the electronic payment stuff, but we want to protect identity, okay, of whoever is making the payment. So the way this is done conceptually is that you first generate a coin. Okay, coin is, or you basically say it's a $10 bank note, okay, an electronic note that is generated. Okay, now each note may have a sequence number on it. Okay, but so that tells you that this is this number. So just as any bank note has a number, this electronic note will also have a sequence number. Okay, but this sequence number is only known to you. Okay, so you can use a program, but something generates a coin or a note for you with a number, okay, a unique number. Okay, then what you do is you have to get this note signed by the bank. Okay, but to do that, you don't want to even tell your bank what the note number is. So you basically do what is called blinding, where you may just basically, you can remove, not remove, but just say blind the sequence number on the note. Okay, and just show up to the bank and say, please sign this. Okay, this is the equivalent of you wrote a check, okay, but you put it in an envelope and you just ask the bank saying, just put a stamp saying, I will honor this payment. Okay, so the bank knows that you have asked for this $10 check, okay, and it has signed it. Okay, and so bank only agrees to give $10. So if you did something weird, then the bank is not going to honor it. But so long as you said it's $10, bank will pay it at some later point. But bank doesn't know the number of the check, or in this case, the sequence number of the coin. Okay, so blinded it, you send it to the bank will sign your blinded coin, okay, and send it back to you. Okay, at this point, you can unblind it, so you can actually generate the sequence number again, okay, so that you can show what it is, and then you can make the payment. Okay, so in this case, the payee will get the coin from you, and all the payee has to do is verify the validity of this coin, saying is this a valid or a forged banknote. Okay, so because there's a signature, you can just go back to the bank and saying, did you sign it, or if it's signed with, let's say, RSA, you can just use the bank's public key and verify that the bank signed it. You don't even have to really go to the bank as is shown there. Okay? And you are done. So basically, you have just made a payment. And then at some later point, the payee can actually get the payment from the bank. Okay? Is this clear? What is being done? So this is the basic idea. Now, this involves, so there is a protocol which I will not really talk about, because this is the whole protocol that I just mentioned on the previous slide, but this is not used in practice because there are other slightly more convenient ways of doing the same thing, right? So so you may want to, in the previous case, you may want to protect, why would you want to be protect your identity? There are many reasons. So one is, maybe you are buying some goods from someone you don't know or don't trust, so you don't want to give a credit card number. This is the most common example, right? So you bought something on eBay. You don't know who was selling it, right? So you don't want to give them your credit card number. Then not only did the item not show up, but they also got your credit card number. So that's bad, So you don't want things like that to happen. So if you want to protect yourself, you instead of doing the previous kind of scenario, you can use third-party payment services. And the easiest example to sort of understand this is PayPal. Okay? So you don't really give your card number to them. You instruct a payment service saying, I authorize you to pay someone else. But they will not give any personal information like your credit card number to them. Okay? Now, this does not strictly preserve anonymity, but it does give you a higher level of privacy than this scenario, where you actually give your credit card number to the merchant. So there you are making a payment but withholding the credit card number. Okay, so not full privacy, but it gives you some additional degree of privacy or anonymity than this scenario. Okay. eCash is basically you just show up with this thing and nobody even knows who you are. You just give them an electronic coin and they just verify it's $10 and you walk out. They don't even know who you are. Okay, that gives you full anonymity. Okay, is this clear? What I just mentioned here. So these are electronic payment systems, and the heart of it is all you have to do encryption, authentication, digital signatures, all of the things that we talked about earlier. Okay, so you can use these building blocks to build these payment services and whatnot. Any questions here before I stop on this topic and move on? Yes, your question.
So you make unblinded, like the payee gets something unblinded. So and the bank gets something which is blinded. Why?
Right. So question is, so in this case, your bank doesn't know who you are, so they cannot track anything back to you. So this is the same thing. You go to ATM, okay, you withdraw some money. And so long as you assume that the bank is not keeping track of serial numbers and who withdrew this money, they don't really know who actually got this $20, right? So you just got some money from the bank. Bank just knows you've withdrawn it, but they don't know what bank notes you have. So you can go and make that payment to someone. And even if they went back to your bank, the bank doesn't know who actually got the money. So the same thing is true here. You're asking the bank to sign a blinded coin, which means the bank guarantees that it's a $10 note, but it doesn't have any way to track it back to you.
So as a result of which, the payee also cannot track it back to you.
Yeah, exactly. So if the payee, now typically it's easier said than done, because if you're buying some goods online, you have to specify your name and shipping address and whatnot, right? So they still know who you are. But suppose this was equivalent of walking into a store and just giving somebody a sort of electronic payment. And so then they don't know who you are, right? So you just walk out with some goods and whatnot. So in that case, if they go back to the bank, they just get the $10, but there's no trail left as to who you are and who actually bought these goods. Okay? Yes, your question.
Bank has to know who you are, right?
Bank knows you're a customer, but suppose that there are lots of people doing the same thing, right? They cannot take an individual coin and then go back and say, this person actually withdrew this coin or this, I signed this coin, so I know who made this payment. So they cannot figure that out.
Bank doesn't know exactly which coin they gave you.
Yes.
But they know that.
Yes, you are a customer. Of course, the bank knows that you are a customer. Otherwise, they wouldn't sign your thing. Yeah. So what I'm saying is that they don't know who bought these goods, right? So it's the same thing as an ATM. They need to know you are a customer and you have the bank balance. They'll give you whatever you're withdrawing from the ATM. But lots of people are doing the same thing. So they are not, presumably, I don't know if they do, but they are not keeping track of who withdrew which bills. So nobody can then go back and say, tell me who withdrew this bill with this number. So they don't know that. The same thing is true here. They'll know that it's their customer, but they don't know which customer. And since they've guaranteed it, they'll just pay. In this case, yes.
In fact, the e-cash is equivalent to the bank check, but has no name on it.
Yes, exactly. So it's like a check, but there is no name. Bank just guarantees to make the payment. And that's exactly what it is. Okay, yes.
Isn't the signature going to contain some ID? Because the signature might be unique for each coin in some sense.
No, so here the bank puts it, signs it, let's say, with its private key. So you just know, let's say, Bank of America signed it, but you don't, it's not individual, right, to each coin. You just basically put your digital signature. So that's what is done. Any other questions here? Okay, so let's move on. Okay, so now we'll switch gears and move on to the next topic, which is distributed file systems. Okay, so we have actually skipped one chapter. We are going to come back to it. So we are on chapter 9. This is chapter 11. Okay, we'll come back to 10 and after we do this. Okay. So today we'll do a quick overview of standalone to understand distributed file system. We're going to first talk about standalone or Unix-like file systems. We'll talk a little bit about issues in distributed file systems. And I'm going to actually talk about NFS today, although this is next class. We'll start with NFS, and then we'll do some other case studies. Okay, this should be CODA, not code. There's a typo there. So that's a distributed file system. XFS is yet another distributed file system. And if there's time, we'll do one called log structured file system, which is not distributed per se, but it is used in variety of other distributed file systems. Okay, that's the overview of this topic. So let's start with file system basics. So here we'll assume a Unix file system to be our canonical file system. Okay, there are others which make different assumptions. For example, Windows uses NTFS. There the assumptions are slightly different, but concepts are broadly similar. Okay. Now the first thing in Unix is, what's a Unix file? A Unix file is just some container of data that is not really interpreted by the files, file system or the operating system. Okay. So it's just container of bits. What are these bits is not interpreted. It could be data, it could be a program, it could be a music file or something else. Okay? As far as the file system is concerned, it doesn't care. It just knows that this is just a collection of bits that it needs to store on disk, okay, and allow for later retrieval. Okay? So the file system basically gives you a logical view of data and storage function. So it is storing these bits for you, but it gives you a higher level interface that allows you to go and access your data at later time. Okay? So you can associate file names with every file. Okay? These are human readable names that you can then remember and say, okay, I stored my assignment and whatever, homework5.txt. Okay, so this, then you can go back to your data at some later point using this human readable user friendly interface. Okay. And the file system itself gives you ability to create, modify, delete files and so on. Also allows you to share data, okay, with other users and provides protection, which means also allows you to protect your data if you don't want to share it. Okay, so these are all the functionality that file systems provide. So Unix file systems, file is a linear array of bytes. Okay, there are no structure to the file is assumed, neither are there file types. Okay, there are file systems where a file is a set of records. Okay? Each record is a fixed size, and then you can access files in a structured manner using records and whatnot. None of that is supported by a Unix file system. Okay? So directory is basically yet another file. Okay? In Unix, everything is a file. That's their basic abstraction. Directory is another file. This is a special file that the users cannot write to. And this is just a file that contains a table of what other files are present in that directory. Okay, that's all that is there in the directory. It's file names and inode numbers. It's just a table. Okay, and the file structure. So all file systems today are hierarchical in nature, which means you have directories and subdirectories and so on. And the leaves are all actual files. Okay, leaves of this. And this structure is a directed acyclic graph. Okay, it's not a tree. It's a directed acyclic graph because you can have symbolic links and hard links going from one directory to another, okay, which makes it a DAG as opposed to a tree. Okay, so here it says directories may not be shared, but files may be shared. Why? In this graph.
Since we are different files, you can specify different
attributes for these different files. Repeat what you just said. I didn't follow what you just said. So shared as in, I think I should make what I mean by shared explicit. So here is, let's say, the file tree, right? So you have slash, user, your local bin, this may have, and so on. Okay. So there is something called a hard link, which allows you to basically have one name alias some other name. Okay. So you could have, let's say, bar. And this name be linked to that name via hard link. So whenever you access this, you are actually accessing that. where the file system ensures this. So this allows you, so this is symbolic links or shortcuts and hard links, all of them provide this functionality. Now hard links actually within the file system allow you to alias. Okay? Soft link is a different problem, I'll talk about them in just a moment. Now the point that is being made there is directories may not directly be hard linked, but files can be hard linked, and why is the question. As far as soft links or symbolic links are concerned, there is no restriction. You can make a soft link from anything to anything else. However, hard links, you don't necessarily support that in Unix. Any ideas why? Yes. You can get cycles, because if I said that the structure is assumed to be a DAG. Okay? If you allow links to basically, if you basically construct a hard link to any of your ancestor, you're going to get a cycle. Cycles are bad in file systems. Okay? Because if you have any program that does some recursive thing like find, or you have recursive backup, you're going to loop forever. Okay, that doesn't work. So this is to be avoided, which is why you prevent hard links between directories. That's the only way to avoid it. Otherwise, you have to always do a check when you construct a hard link to see if there is a cycle, which is more expensive. So if you just prevent it altogether, then there is no question of a cycle being formed. Okay. On the other hand, you can make soft links, but it's known that a soft link is a soft link. So any recursive program will not follow soft links, for example. So if you do a tar, okay, tar will just encode the soft link but will not follow it. If it followed it and there was a cycle, it would just keep expanding forever, never stop. It will never terminate. Okay, so this is a key design decision that Unix file systems have made. Okay. Now, directory, what does a directory contain? It has a file name, it has an inode number, a major device number, a minor device number. So as I said, it's a table. It's like any other file, but except that it basically stores information about other files. Okay, for every file, it stores an inode, okay, or an index node. So inodes are the key data structures where metadata for the file is stored. Okay. Inodes allow you a way to get to the actual data that a file contains. Okay. So what does the inode have? It has all of the file attributes as well as a multi-level index. Okay. So file attributes. So it would have information like who's the owner, what's the group, what are the access control bits, the read, write, execute bits, the creation time, last modification, and all of this information is stored in an inode. And then the last thing is it has to have a set of pointers that point to the data blocks of the file. Okay, that's where the data for the file is actually contained. So you have an array here. Okay, so you'll have block 0, block 1, and so on. This actually points to a disk block. So there's a disk. So this tells you here is block 1 of the file. Okay, this says go to this disk and it's on block number N. Okay, and then this would basically point you to the next block and so on. Okay. So in order to actually read or write a file, you first have to get the inode and then look up this array, see where the block is on file, and then actually read that block. Then you get to that. That part of the file.
Is
the
block as big as a page?
So disk block, is it as big as a page is the question. So typically disk blocks in Unix operating systems vary from 1K to 8K. Okay, you can specify that at file creation time. It's not something that is mandated. Okay? Page size is mandated by the hardware. You can't go and change it. Okay, but when you create the file system, there will be a default block size, but you can change it. Okay, when you create do make FS or format the file system. Okay. Now there is a special block on your file system called the super block. Okay, super block is where all the inodes themselves are stored. Okay, when you construct the file system, oops, let me lock this down. Okay. So when you create the file system, this a special block, or actually it's not one, but multiple of these are constructed on disk, where all of the inodes are located. Okay? Because if the inodes are not at known locations, you are in trouble. You don't know how to get to the inode itself. Okay, so if you remember what I said, the directory actually has the file name and the inode number. It doesn't tell you the inode location. It only tells you the inode number. So it will say this file foo has inode, is all of its metadata is stored in inode 10. That's all it is going to tell you. It doesn't tell you where inode 10 is. Okay, the reason for this is inode 10 is at a known location. It is the 10th inode in the super block, and super block is always at a known location. Okay. Otherwise, if you didn't do this, you would have to store not only the file name and the inode number, but the inode location in here. Okay, this is something to keep in mind. Okay, so here is the inode structure that I was mentioning. There's a mode, the owner ID, group ID, visit a file or a directory. Protection bit, there are all sorts of access times, size of the file, number of blocks it contains, there's a ref count here, which I'll talk about in a moment, and then there is this index. Okay? Now this index, the important thing here, index is a multi-level index, it's not a single level index. This allows you to construct file sizes, files of arbitrary sizes. Okay? So the first 12 blocks or 12 entries in this array, okay, address 0 to address 11, they are direct block pointers, meaning that this would actually store the disk block number where that data is stored. Okay? If the file grows beyond 12 blocks, okay, then the 13th entry here, let's call it address, not block, just to be consistent. So this is the 13th entry. This points to an indirect block, okay, and that itself would then point to data blocks. So there's one level of indirection gets added if you grow beyond 12 blocks. Okay. Typically, this would have up to 10, would have enough space to store 1024 additional blocks or pointers. Okay. It has space to have store 1024 pointers. Now, if you grow beyond 12 plus 1024 blocks, you go to the next entry here. Okay. And this would be a double indirect, meaning that this would point to a data block, which would itself point to other data blocks, and they would actually point to blocks of the file. Okay. So that allows you to have 1024 square additional blocks of the file. And if you grow beyond that, you have one last triple indirect block there, which will have three levels of indirection. Okay. Is this clear? Presumably also known. So, yes. That's what I was just showing here, right? So the first 12 entries are direct pointers. Okay. The 13th entry is two levels of indirection. So this would have a pointer to a block that would itself have pointers to actual data block. When you do double indirect, there is three pointers. So you have pointers from here to the disk block that points to another one that points to here, the actual block, and then triple indirect.
That means if your file is such as large,
yep,
you should use such as a single double
link. You know, it'll keep growing, right? So yeah, you know, as the file increases, you'll just keep filling these things. If it grows beyond 12 blocks, it will allocate a block entry here and a disk block here. Then you'll start filling pointers here. Okay. Yes. Once it grows beyond that, you'll allocate the next one. Then you'll start filling the first entry here, and that will point a block. You'll fill that. Once you fill that, create a second block, it will point to blocks and so on. So it will just keep growing in this fashion. Okay? Yes, question there. Can you have holes in the file? Yes. In Unix files, allow you to have holes. Okay, so what you can do is you just do a seek to an arbitrary location, and then you can write to that location. What that would do in this case, let's say, let me just erase. So typically when you write to a file, you start from the beginning and you keep writing and the file keeps growing. Okay? But there's no reason to do that. Unix allows, like any other file system, random access. So you can just seek to an arbitrary location and you can write to that location. Okay, if that location happens to be greater than the size of the file, then you have to go to that appropriate pointer, fill it out, create a data block and write to that. What's
the
Yes. Yes. If it's a linked list, then you cannot have holes. You would have to fill it out. Okay? Is this clear, what I just said?
since you have a different blocks path, it means every file should has a maximum limit of size.
Yes, every file has a maximum limit of size, which would be 12 plus 1024. This is the number of blocks, not number of bytes. Square. That's the maximum number of blocks you can have in this file system. Okay? Any other questions here? Is this clear? We're still doing primer. Okay, so the advantage of having this structure, so you can ask, why do we have all this complexity? Why not just say all files can have these many blocks and the inode is always a multi-level index? Okay, so it's always a three-level index from the very beginning. So why not have that structure? That's a much simpler. So it's a three-dimensional area. That's basically what that is. So you are going to waste space. Also, there's an efficiency issue, right? So if the file is small, you still have three lookups in order to get to the first block of the file. Okay, Unix file systems are optimized for the common case, which is files are small. Okay, many studies show that the average size of a file on any arbitrary system tends to be less than 10 kilobytes. If you take all the files on your machine and you find the average size is going to be less than 10 kilobytes, because large number of files are very small. Some small number of files are very large. Okay? So the common case is small file, we have to optimize for small file. That's precisely what this does. Okay? Since most files are small, they will always have less than 12 blocks, which means that you can get to the data in one lookup. Okay? But if you, it also accommodates gracefully larger and larger. As the size grows, the penalty for lookup also grows, meaning you have to do multi-level lookups in order to get to the data. Okay?
Can we use the inode to identify actual file in the disk?
Can you use it to identify a file?
Can we use the inode to solely identify a file in the actual disk?
Yes. So for every file, there's a unique inode. And the inode has all of the information for that file. Okay? Now, just to go back to this efficiency case, Linux does one extra optimization. If the file is really small, it doesn't even construct a block for it. It just stores all the data in the inode itself. Like if you have create a file with, let's say, 10 bytes, okay, because there are more than 10 bytes here, it will actually store all the 10 bytes in the inode. You don't even have to construct a block. This special optimization they do. So as soon as you access the inode, the data is all actually contained in the inode, okay, for extremely small files. Okay. So now, with that background, let's move on to distributed file system. So this is all centralized file system, which means there's a local disk and the machine is accessing files on a local disk. So in a distributed file system, you have to provide a functionality whereby you can access files stored on another machine, not on your local disk. Okay, so that is basically what a DFS or a distributed file system allows you to do. And in any distributed file system, we distinguish between the file service and the file server. Okay? The file service is basically the interface that you use to access files on a different machine. Okay? This is the API and whatever primitives client uses to access files. The file server is an implementation of that API. Okay? So you can have different types of file servers that implement the same API. The reason we distinguish between this is for interoperability. Okay, whenever you create a distributed file system, the kinds of machines that are going to access that files will be heterogeneous in nature. So you specify an API, then anyone can then build a client that can talk to that server using that API. Okay, so that's the basic idea. So you can have different platforms that all support the same file system, okay, because they all implement the same file service. So that's the basic idea, and all file systems that are distributed have this distinction. Okay, so let's talk about the file service. So within the file service, there are two models of building a file system. One is called the upload-download model, and then the other one, so that's the upload-download model, and the other one is remote access model. Okay? In remote access, if you want to access a file or any part of the file, you send a request to the server. the server accesses that part of the file and sends you back the result. Okay, that's what is shown here. So every time you want to access a file, the file always stays on the server. So you want to access, let's say, the first 100 bytes of the file, you send a request saying, give me the first 100 bytes. Okay, the server is going to access that data and send you back a buffer containing it. In the upload-download model, whenever you try to access a file, the file is actually brought over, or a copy of it is brought over to the local machine, and all subsequent accesses are local. Okay, so that's what you download. And if you modify it, then at some later point you have to upload it back to replace the file, okay, that was originally present on the server. So these are two models that are used. Okay. This model is more common, but that model can provide better performance for lots of accesses to the same file. Because once you get the file over, okay, all subsequent accesses are local and they're very fast. Okay. Now, here are some pros and cons that are basically true for these two models. Work is done at the server. Most of the work is done at the client. Here, server can be... I think I switched this. Yeah, so this can actually have a stateless server, as is done in NFS, but certain servers can also be stateful. Okay, there I think it's incorrect. This cannot be stateless. This should be stateful, because the server has to keep track of which clients have copies of files and bring them back and so on. Okay, so here you have to keep some state. So in both cases, consistency is always an issue. Okay, now here consistency is simpler to address. Okay, because everything is happening at the server. If there are two clients, two different machines writing to the same file, all writes are going to arrive at the server. You can implement whatever consistency model you want. You can order the writes however you want and modify the file. Okay. In this case, consistency is a little more tricky. Okay, because if one client downloads the file and starts modifying it, and some other file client is trying to read it, you are in trouble if that read actually goes to the server and reads the old copy of the file. Okay, so you have to, not that it's hard, but you have to keep track of who is reading, who is writing, and make sure everything is consistent. Okay, server could be a bottleneck here because all of the requests. So it's always assumed that there are many clients and one server. Okay, so server becomes a bottleneck there. In the other case, clients do most of the work. Okay, so it's more scalable. So this is broad concepts. We'll see how these are instantiated in NFS and other file systems. Okay, so we have already talked many times about differences between stateful servers and stateless server in the abstract. The same trade-offs hold even for distributed file system. Okay, one is more resilient to server crashes, the other one is not. In this case, in the stateless server, every time a client actually sends a request, it has to provide all of the information it needs, saying it is this such and such machine, this is the user, so that the server can make sure you have access rights to the file. Okay, so here the request has to encode a lot of this information. In stateful server, you authenticate once and the server checks once that you have access to the file. But beyond that, you don't have to do anything. Okay. This acts like a centralized file system. Okay, whenever you open a file, you get a file descriptor. From that point on, you only specify the file descriptor and the file system doesn't do any more checks whether you have access rights to the file and so on. It's only done at open time. Okay. But there is state inside the kernel which keeps track of what a file descriptor, how file descriptor map to files. Okay. Same is true here. Okay. When you open the file for the first time and it's a stateful server, you will do the check and you will give back a handle which is equivalent to a file descriptor. Subsequently, you just present the handle. It tells the server that you have access rights and it will allow you to do whatever operation you want. Okay. Okay. So let's look at NFS and try to understand how NFS works and what kind of, okay, your question then. Why is idempotency easy? Because if it's a stateless file server, it is not keeping track of the state. So if a subsequent request comes, it doesn't know that a request has been processed already. Okay. What does idempotency mean? So the assumption is that some messages between the client and the server can get lost and the client is retransmitting the request. Since it is stateless here, okay, the server doesn't know anything. what has happened in the past. In this case, you can keep state, so you know which requests have been processed. Okay, so you can, if you already processed the request, you can ensure you don't redo it. Okay. Any other questions? Okay, simple example would be create file. Okay, so suppose you issue a create request and the file wasn't present, it will get created the first time around. Okay, now if the server cannot ensure idempotency and you reissue the create and you don't know you've already processed it, it's going to give an error the second time because now the file exists on the server. Okay, but if you had state, you would know that this is retransmission of the same request, so you can just return a success. It just as one example of where idempotency matters. Okay, so NFS, it's a network called it's an acronym for SANS Network File System. It's widely used in practice, and we'll look at how it works. Okay, so here is a client, here is a server. Okay, the assumption is there are files on the server that this client wants to access. Okay. Now, the way Unix operating systems support multiple file systems, including NFS, is through this mechanism called the VFS layer or the virtual file system layer. Okay. This allows you to support multiple file systems transparently to clients. Okay. All clients do is they just use the same interface, open, read, write, close, to access any arbitrary file system. Okay. It could be a FAT file system, it could be a local file system, UFS, it could be NFS. This is not known to the client. Okay. Client just says open, specifies a file name. Okay. It could be a local file, it could be a remote file. All this is handled transparently by the kernel for you through what is called the virtual file system layer. So here is an example of how this layer allows you to access both local files stored on this disk as well as remote files stored on that other disk using the same interface. Okay. So you open a file and then so there's a system call layer. All of those file system calls are sent to the VFS layer. Okay. What happens at the VFS layer is you check, is this file local or not? Okay. If it is local, you basically hand that request processing to the local file system code. Okay. If it is remote, in this case, let's say the remote file system is NFS, you hand that request to the NFS client code, okay, which is then going to set up a connection, get that, and so on. Okay. So this is basically also called the VFS switch because this is basically a large case statement. You say, is this local file system, is this a FAT file system? If so, you give it to that component of the file. If it's, is it a EXT3 file system, then you give it to EXT3 code. If it's NFS, give it to NFS code. Yes, question.
Is this check done by name or
is it done by name,
yeah,
of the file?
What is the criteria for checking if it's a local versus?
What's the criteria? So I haven't actually shown you all of the NFS code. So let's assume this is a file system tree. User, local, and this is where you do equivalent of a network drive map, and this is where you mounted a remote file system. Okay? When you specify a path name, it traverses the tree, okay, and it tries to figure out whether it has actually reached a local file system or not.
What if there was same name files on both?
Yeah, so you could have the same name file, but when you mount it here, you cannot use the same name, right? Because what you will mount it is, so suppose you mount it here, you will basically have to specify MNT user bin foo.
Okay, so you have to specifically give a full path.
You have to give a full path when you open the file. Yeah, of course. So here is also your bin foo. So you can't use the same file name. Okay, you will have a unique name for every file. Any questions here? Okay. So if it is actually an NFS file that you have to access over NFS, you go down this path, you go to the NFS client, it will then send it over to our RPC. We already talked about how NFS works over RPC and we did some RPC. So you go to the server stub, go to the NFS server here. NFS server says this is a local file. It goes back, it sends it back to the VFS layer. Okay. Then the VFS layer actually sends it back down to the local file system. You access the file and then you send the results back in the reverse path all the way back to the client. Okay? This is how the VFS layer allows you to access both local files and remote files transparently from the end client perspective. Okay? The end client doesn't have to worry about whether it's local or not. Okay, so the other thing I want to mention is right now the NFS implementations that you see on machines, they are called NFS version 3. Okay? And there's a new version of NFS that has just been released not too long ago, maybe a year or two back, called NFS version 4. There are fundamental differences between the two. Okay? So here is basically a table that shows every operation and then what that operation means as well as what NFS version 3 does and what NFS version 4 does. The biggest difference between NFS version 3 and earlier and 4 is that version 3 was stateless. Okay, NFS version 3 protocol is a stateless protocol. The server doesn't maintain any state. But version 4 is a stateful protocol. Okay, the server actually keeps track of state. Okay, and we'll see why you have to keep track of state and so on as we do this case study and understand what NFS does. Okay. Now, this is a long table, but I just want to point your attention to a few things. Okay, so let's look at the open call. Okay, you will see that in NFS version 3, the open is not even supported. Okay, but in NFS version 4, open is supported. Okay, so why would that be? There is no concept of opening a file in NFS version 3. So if you think about what does opening a file do? Okay, when you open a file, what does the file system do? Any file system has first check, does the file exist? Okay? If not, you have to create the file.
Yeah.
Okay? And if it already exists, then you have to see, does this user have authority to access the file? You're going to do a check that look at all the read, write bits and say, what is this user who's trying to access it? Does he or she have access rights to the file? Okay, and then you will either return a success or a failure. Okay, and then if it's a success, you go give back a file descriptor and you keep state inside the operating system saying this file has been opened and so on. Okay, I said that NFS version 3 is stateless. Okay, so it doesn't have the notion of a state that any file descriptors have to be sent. So there's no concept of opening a file. Okay, but so then you can ask the question, I'm a client, I do whatever, F open or open. Okay, what should NFS do in this case? Because there's no concept of opening. So if it's NFS version 3, what does it do? Okay, clearly it has to first check whether the file exists and what the access rights are. Okay, so that it can decide whether to give you access to the file or not. And that is done via this lookup mechanism. Okay. Lookup is supported. So open, basically, if you do open at the application level, in NFS version 3, that translates into what are called lookup calls. Lookup just says, okay, does it file exist? Does the user have permission to access the file and so on? And you just check and just decide whether it succeeds or not. Once it succeeds, then you don't have to do anything beyond that point. Okay? Is this clear?
You mean the local, operating system keep state of
Yes. So local operating system is, so in this case, let's say you do open here. Okay. The NFS client is actually going to translate that open into lookup calls. Okay. And then it will get back some response. In particular, what the NFS server will do is it will give you what's called a magic handle, which is a very large integer that allows you to subsequently access the file. Remember that there is no state at the file, at the server. Okay. Sorry? In version 3, there is no state being maintained at the server. So in other words, you will not be able to figure out whether subsequently the user has access to the file or not. Okay? So you encode this as a magic handle and you give it back to the client. And subsequently, if you want to do any subsequent read or write, you can just give the magic handle and go back to the server. And say, here is my handle that says I have rights to access this file. I want you to do this operation. And the server is just going to look at the handle and then say, okay, fine, I'll do this, whatever you're asking. Okay. This also means that NFS is prone to spoofing. Okay. Yeah, so The handle is no different than a web cookie. If you remember, we had the same discussion in web server design, that the web server can keep state or not keep state of the shopping cart. Okay, you could encode your shopping cart as a cookie and send it back to the client, and the server becomes stateless. So subsequently, if you want to do something, you go back with the cookie and say, I want to do this operation. Okay? The magic handle is the same concept. Okay, you're basically saying, here is some information, I'm going to encode it in this cookie, which we call a handle, and you give it back to the client. And then subsequently, if you present the cookie, the server will just allow you to access the file without doing any further checks. Okay, what this also means is that if you could guess the cookie for a file, you can access the file even though you have no rights to that file, because the server is not going to do any additional checks for you. Okay. So the cookie is a long integer, but that is also the reason NFS is prone to security spoofs, where if you could guess a cookie for a file, the user, there may be access permissions that say nobody can access the file. Okay, but I present a cookie that says, okay, I can access the file. You already gave me this cookie. The server will allow you to read it. Okay, so this is a problem with NFS. Okay, so anyway, so coming back to our discussion here, so there's no concept of an open. If the client doesn't open, you will actually just do a bunch of these lookup calls. But NFS version 4 is stateful. So it will actually keep state on the server saying this client has opened the file and whatnot, and it will actually allow you to do the right things there. Okay. Now again, the other difference is that there is a create call there. Okay, you'll see that in case of create, version 3 supports it, but version 4 does not support create. Okay. And this is the opposite of what you have for open. The reason for this is, if you do an open in NFS version 3, okay, open behaves like a regular local open. So first thing you check is, does the file exist in open? And if it doesn't, you just call create. This is what happens on the local file system. Same thing is going to happen in NFS. You will do lookup, see if the file exists. If not, you will just call create and create the file. Okay, that is the reason you need to support create. In case of NFS version 4, since you already have open, okay, there is no reason to do a separate create call, because the NFS client can issue an open, okay, and then have the server just create it if the file doesn't exist. So you don't have to issue a separate create.
So
okay, yes.
Why any change to version 4? Because of the security reasons?
Why is it version 4?
Yes.
Versions evolve, so there's a new version. Better. I'll talk more about what version 4 does.
So maybe you can support open, maybe you
yeah.
can.
So it is, there is some advantages of using state. I'll talk about all sorts of disadvantages that NFS version 3 had and what V4 does to avoid or sort of get around those problems.
What is the difference between regular and non-regular file?
What's the difference? Regular file is just a file. Non-regular file is anything like a directory, a symbolic link, and whatnot. Okay. So here is basically what I had just mentioned. This is the kind of communication that you see NFS traffic going back and forth. So initially, when you open the file, you do a lookup. Okay, so that in version 3, you will look up the name, you'll come back, and then you will issue a read, and then you do reads and so on. Okay. Now NFS, the first optimization that NFS version 4 does is what are called compound RPCs. Okay. What a compound RPC is was multiple RPCs specified in one request or one packet. Okay. So rather than do this two-level operation, here's a compound RPC which says look up a file, and if it exists, open the file, and then read the first block of the file. You just send one RPC request, but that has three RPC commands in it. And then all three operations are done by the server, and you get back a response. So compound RPCs are an optimization. They just prevent the performance optimization. They just avoid this multiple round trip times and give you better performance, because in one round trip, you have done three things instead of three separate RPCs that require three RTTs. This is the first performance optimization why NFS version 4 can give you better performance. And we'll talk more about them in just a few minutes. But let's talk about this mount protocol that I triggered a question earlier. Okay. So the way you access any file on a server, any remote file on the server, is that you first have to establish a mapping to those files. Okay? Context of Windows, this is equivalent to setting up a network drive. You have this F drive and so on. That creates a mapping between a remote volume, and it gives it a local name, which is that drive name. Okay? There's the same concept in NFS, which is called the mount protocol, that takes a remote volume, okay, and it establishes a mapping in the local hierarchy. That is precisely what is shown here. So this is your NFS server. Okay? This is the local file system tree. Okay? So here is a user who logs in, and his or her files are actually stored on the file server. Home directory is resident on the server. Okay, but when you log in, you want to actually mount the directory or create a mapping so that the files in the home directory can be accessed locally. This is the most common use of NFS. You have a workstation, all the home directories reside on the server. When you log in, your home directory is mapped onto the local machine so you can access it. So this is called the mount protocol. So you take this part of the subtree, which is the home directory for this user, and you establish a mapping which is equivalent to a network drive here. So now if you say /remote/vu/teen, you basically go down this path and you start accessing all of the files. You could have mounted them in /home, for example. Okay, that's what Linux does by default. Okay, home directory is just mounted on /home, and so you can access home, your username, all your files are in that. Although the files are remote, that's how you access all your files on your machine. Okay, so to do this notion of a mount, you have to first, the server has to do what is called an export. An export is basically a table which says all of these other clients have permission to access these files. Yeah, this basically says I export this part of my subtree, and here are all the machines that can actually create network mappings to this. Okay. So you have to be in the export. Any client has to be in the export list in order to even access files on the server. So assuming you are on the access list, then you issue the mount command, which is equivalent of creating this network drive, okay, on your machine. So these are the two things that the mount protocol has. Okay. Now, whenever you have these mounts and so on, you have problems of recursion. Okay. This is not the case in Windows, because every network drive gets a unique drive name. Okay, there's no hierarchy. So you have a D drive that may mount, that may have a network mapping to some file, and then you may have an F drive that's something else. But that's not the case in case of NFS. Because this is hierarchical, you can have problems. So here is a scenario where there are two servers and one client. Okay? So this server A, okay, this is the file system on server A, and server A has already mounted this part of the subtree here. So when you access files on server A, you can go down this tree, and when you access these files, it will get them from here. Okay? But it also exports this larger subtree to this client. Okay? And this entire subtree is now mounted here. Okay? So you could ask the question, saying if this client now goes down this way, okay, should this server then get these other files from that server and serve them here? Because recursion, right? So you have one mount inside another mount. Okay, should you traverse these mounts recursively? Okay. Now, NFS version 3 does not allow recursive mounts, okay, which means that you can mount this subtree here. Okay. But if you try to descend down this hierarchy, you are going to get an error, because this server is going to say, these files are not local to me. They are actually mounted from some other server. I am not going to serve them to you recursively. Yeah, because one technique would have been, you go down here, you basically send the request here. Then since this is another mount, this server would have sent that request there, gotten the response and sent it back to you. Okay, NFS version 3 does not allow recursion for security reasons. Yeah, because this is basically a problem of trust. Yeah, so for example, when you export this, so server B may have put server A in its export list. Okay, so it is allowing server A to access these files. But it may not have put this client in its server list. So when this server actually asks that server for the file, that server has no way of knowing, is this locally needed or some other client wants it. And if server B does not trust this client, then if you allow recursive mount, then you have a problem. You just expose all your files to a machine you don't trust. Okay, because all of the requests to these files are coming through server A, so B doesn't know where the requests are really coming from. Because if you avoid recursive mounts altogether, and there is no breach of trust from a security standpoint. Okay, so now having argued all that, NFS version 4 relaxes this and allows recursive modes. Okay, so that's something to keep in mind. So the only way to actually access those files there would have been have to do two mounts. Okay, so you mount this and then you mount that subtree directly from B. So then it's clear to this client what to do. If it's descending here and it goes into this part of the subtree, this client directly asks server B, not indirectly through it. Okay? But V4 allows you to do this recursive mounts and you can have these indirections and so on. Okay, so that's something to keep in mind. Okay, the last thing to mention is what is called auto mounting. And auto mounting is just a way of automatically creating these mounts or network mappings on demand rather than statically creating them at boot up time. Okay, so you could have a system that just boots up and creates all of these mount points. Okay, but that may just waste resources if the user is not interested in accessing those volumes. And why create these maps? And then you use up resources. So auto mounts, what it does is the first time you touch a file, it will actually trigger a mount request and mount it on demand. Okay. User logins are the most useful example of where auto mounting is used. Okay, your home directory is mounted on demand when you log into the machine. If you're not logged in, there is no reason to access your directory. Okay, so you don't have that mount mapping. Only when you first log in is that created for you. Okay, this is one example, but there are many reasons to do this auto mounting. Okay, for that, you have a separate process called the auto mounter, which talks to NFS. Okay, whenever it sees access to a file that's a mount point, it will send a mount request, mount it for you, and then let the request continue. Any questions on this? Okay, so we have basically run out of time, but let me just mention one thing and leave it at that. These are the file attributes that are supported in NFS. So NFS protocol is designed to be very flexible. Okay, it was designed so that any client, or rather any server, can be used to share any type of file. So the underlying file system can be generic. You can even take a DOS file system, okay, and export it over NFS. Okay, NFS is just a layer that runs on your regular file system. You can take that regular file system and export it. So to prevent sharing across a wide variety of local file systems, basic NFS protocol is very simple. Okay. It just says that all the requirement that it imposes on the underlying file system is that file system support these four attributes. Okay. Type of the file, which is this file a regular file or a directory or a symbolic link. Size of the file. Okay. Some way for the client to check whether the file has changed or to provide consistency. And an ID of the file system. So you can see that by default, you're not even assuming that there will be users or owners of the file or access permissions of the file and so on. Okay. And this allows you to support everything all the way back to a FAT file system. It doesn't really have the notion of a user. In FAT, there is no permissions, no users. Anyone can create a file. Anyone can delete a file. Okay. So in order to interoperate across a large number of file systems, you only have these attributes that need to be supported. And if so, you can write an NFS server that works with that file system. Okay. So next time I'll talk more about other recommended attributes. These are optional attributes that would be nice to have in the file system, but not strictly required. Okay. So let's stop here for today.